The Hard Shoulder with Ciara Kelly and Shane Coleman on News Talk.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Now, with the American midterm elections coming in fast, we're asking today how the Republican Party is managing its messaging and holding their coalition together. Yesterday, we heard from Brett Bruin on how the Democrats were performing ahead of the midterms. But a little bit before the show, I caught up with Greg Swenson, chair of Republicans Overseas UK based in Washington. And I began by asking him, how does he see the next few months playing out, given that currently things are not looking good for President Trump or the party with a 10-point lead for the Democrats?
Yeah, I think there'll be a lot of change in the attitudes over the next few months. Once the war wraps up, I think that obviously is good news for the president. And you're right, you know, several months is a long time. So I think with the war wrapping up, we get gasoline prices down to $3 a gallon. I forget what that is in petrol to, liters. But, you know, it's probably $8 to $10 in the UK and Ireland right now. And it's $4 here in the US. That's a big mover in politics here. I mean, gas prices, it's probably the number one metric. And so it's at $4 now. It was at $4 during the Biden years for different reasons. And we get it back down to $3, and I think the midterms can start looking better. Some of the metrics look pretty good right now, surprisingly, although the Democrats have really run the table on more recent elections, you know, off-year elections or special elections. Democrats have been really killing it, and so something's got to change. Or if the election was in May,
we'd be in trouble.
We'd be in trouble, for sure.
You've mentioned several times the war wrapping up. But a lot of people say we still don't know when the war will wrap up or what exactly the off-ramp for the Trump administration will be for the war wrapping up. Do you think that here in America that there is a general acceptance that the conflict with Iran is going to wrap quite soon? Because it's not quite clear to the rest of us, perhaps, that is imminent.
Yeah, it's unclear because we don't actually know what the off-ramp is. I mean, it could be unconditional surrender. It could just be they run out of money, which they will in probably 10 to 20 days when they have to turn off the oil rigs. And that's really that's why I think the president's being patient right now. So I think, you know, a few things will happen. We clear the straits, and that's already starting to look, you know, promising. A couple of ships sailed through yesterday. That's not enough. That's not 20% of the world's oil, but we'll get there.
It was pre all of this about 130 ships passed through on a daily basis. I know you're saying that it could be, there's different ways this could end, unconditional surrender. As someone who spends a lot of time looking at politics and geopolitical analysis, unconditional surrender does not seem to be in the Iranian playbook.
I would say that would be the last or the least likely, because they are suicidal in many ways. They're, you know, apocalyptic, and I think that they're willing to endure
what a Western country might not be willing to endure.
Because the IRGC might bend because they're also capitalists. They own a lot of the businesses in Iran, and so. You know, I think the regime, the mullahs, they will just take it to the end because they'd rather die, a death by bombing or destruction. And they don't care about the economy that much. But I think the IRGC does because they have so much vested interest in the economy. So when that oil business shuts down, which it inevitably will in the next few weeks, that could change things for sure.
Of course, even if it does shut down in the next few weeks, there has been such a deficit in terms of supply globally that the ramifications will probably still be felt economically, globally, till at least the end of the year, way past the midterms taking place. There's also things like the cost of living here. It isn't just oil that has increased in price under the current administration. Ordinary groceries for ordinary Americans, people are struggling to pay for those
slightly,
things. Employment isn't as good as it has been. So the economy in general is problematic.
The private sector's done quite well with job growth and wage growth. And I mean inflation-adjusted wage growth. So we lost $3,000 on average in income in the Biden years. We've captured $1,200 back. The problem is we're still down 2,000. So people still feel poor. Mm-hmm. People still feel like prices are higher and their wages didn't keep up, even though in the last year wages have recovered. But we need more of that. It doesn't matter that it was Biden's fault or the Democrats' fault. What matters is people feel poor and they're going to blame who's ever in office.
Well, so they are, but also some of the issues around tariffs, et cetera, have created problems for, it has ended up American consumers have been paying for tariffs.
Slightly, maybe some one-time price adjustments.
What I'm saying is you can't blame Biden or previous administrations for the economics of the current administration.
Which the Democrats have done really well is the message is, hey, the tariffs have caused inflation. They have not, actually. And core inflation is down. So what we saw last month was, yes, inflation went up, including gas and food. Those are volatile. And again, that doesn't mean that people don't suffer from that. But core inflation is down. So this is good news long term, even though it's a short term sacrifice. For sure. I'm not going to argue that.
Greg, the Democrats have a 10-point lead over the Republicans currently. And I'd say it's a long time away. But if that follows through to the midterm elections, and the Democrats then are on track to flip the Senate.
Yeah.
What will that mean for the administration?
I think the Senate would be particularly bad news, mm-hmm. because then they could block everything that comes from the White House. And so I think that would be bad news. It wouldn't change that much overall, because the Big Beautiful Bill was passed a year ago. That was the signature legislation. There isn't that much more, and you notice Congress, it hasn't really passed much in terms of legislation. So I'm not sure that it will change dramatically if we lose the House, and that's likely by most historical metrics. But the Senate, I think, would be a difficult one, and it really hurt in 2020 when we lost those two Georgia Senate seats, and that's really why we had all the spending from the Biden years, the open border. I mean, you name it, like so many of the problems from those years could have been avoided if we had the Senate. And so that's important. And I think it'll be difficult for the president to get anything done.
It will be difficult for the administration to get anything done, that's true. But also, if you lose the Senate and if President Trump and his Republican Party does badly in these midterms,
yeah,
what will that mean for the Trump presidency, in your view? The Republican Party may endure, but the Trump presidency, he will be disempowered. He will no doubt be deeply unhappy. What would you expect to see play out in the run-up to, say, 2028?
Case? Look, obviously we would love to pull off a miracle and win the midterms. It's happened twice since Roosevelt. It's happened twice: Clinton in 1998 and George W. Bush in 2002. Very different times. You had an unbelievable economy in 1998. You had the backlash against the impeachment, and then of course W had the tailwinds of 9/11 and the unity in the country. So those were really unique. The only way the Republicans can win or hold the House is if we get a really robust economic expansion, which we're at the beginning of.
Do you really believe that?
Absolutely.
A lot of people are saying that we're facing into global recessions, that the energy crisis that we're looking at now is worse than post-Ukraine and the two 1970s oil crises combined.
Yeah, I have not heard that. I can't say that that's not true, but I can say that the U.S.
The International Energy Agency said this is the worst energy shock that we have ever seen in the history of modernity.
Right, because demand is so much higher than it was in the 70s and even in with the Ukraine 4 years ago. And so, but the U.S. economy is much more resilient because we're a net exporter of
oil. You are heavily, heavily indebted.
Oh yeah, that's something that keeps us awake at night. There's no doubt about that. And so, we're still the world's reserve currency. We can still print, we can print money.
But
basically,
this is the first time again in modern history that there is a question over the dollar remaining the world's reserve currency.
Yeah,
says something about the world betting on American.
And that's why, that was a valid concern, especially a year ago. But that's why the president has done a really good job with the combination of things. The Venezuela move, that means the Venezuelan oil is all trading in dollars. Iran, blocking the strait. So the move towards
the
dollar.
Do you really believe that the conflict in Iran has been a good move? Who has it been a good move for?
Well, ultimately it will be a good move for the world. It's definitely a good move for the Middle East. That's why the Saudis are way behind it and are really enthused about it. So the short term headaches are obvious, but in the long term it will be great for the region for sure, great for the world, and great for America.
Are you talking about being great for the region if the regime is overthrown? Because many people say that the regime is a many-headed beast, and that is not going to happen.
So there's two possible.
These are experts on Middle Eastern politics.
And they could be right that the regime will never be overthrown. That's a possibility. I can't rule that out. However, they've been completely decapitated in a way. They can't fire missiles. They're going to run out of missiles pretty soon. The military capabilities.
A lot of people think that Russia and China are, particularly by the back door, backing Iran, and that actually they won't run out of money and they won't run out of missiles.
That would be a challenge. I mean, it's hard with the U.S. blockade to ship anything into Iran, like weapons, and also, you know, obviously they can't export oil. So, you know, the move back to the dollar has been pretty significant between Iran and Venezuela and other sort of, you know, chess moves that the president and Scott Bessent especially has executed. So, you know, I think in the long term, even in spite of the near-term economic headaches, in the long term, this will be the regime without a nuclear weapon. That could have been a really bad outcome. But also, they won't be able to harass their neighbors and Americans anymore, and British soldiers as well. I mean, 600 Americans died in Iraq because of Iranian IEDs. You know, that's, you know, the Marine barracks in 1983. This has been going on for 47 years, killing Americans. So we would rather not have young Americans.
I'm absolutely sure, but people would argue that 100,000 people who were from Iraq died during the Gulf War, and that America is widely hated by a significant proportion of the Middle East as a consequence.
Sure, you can argue that we created another, you know, wave of jihadists, you know, with that. And so there's some merit to that. Look, we all have some, you know, some Monday morning quarterbacking on Iraq and Afghanistan.
Let me ask you a little bit about the Voting Rights Act, because this idea, this nationwide redistricting, many people are saying that's a form of racial gerrymandering, and that it's twofold. It's to move, I suppose, districts in a way. You can argue whichever side you're on to favor one group or another, but also that even the timing of it is designed to create, I suppose, concern about the validity of the midterm elections. Do you believe that's true?
No, I don't believe that it's anything to do with validity. I think it's trying to correct some wrongs that have occurred in the past. The racial gerrymandering has been going on for generations, so many of these attempts or changes are attempts to change that. And you know, and enforce civil rights law into voting. The other part of the voting, the big thing with the Voting Rights Act right now, it's not just gerrymandering, because you know, gerrymandering's been around forever. I live in Illinois, which is like the mother of all gerrymandered states. You know, it's 10-3, even though 45% of the people voted Republican. Massachusetts is probably the worst.
Look from, say, Europe at your system, the electoral colleges, and say it's all gerrymandering because you've got two blue stripes down the middle and you've a load of red stripes across the center, and that actually each vote of an American is not equal.
Yeah, you can make that argument because, you know, there's two Senate seats in Wyoming where there are hardly any people. There's only one congressional seat, interestingly enough. And so, you know, but that's to protect the minority, and it was designed that way 250 years ago, not quite 275 years ago, quite deliberately to protect the minority. We didn't want, we didn't want the southern states to have too much power, but also ultimately as we expanded westward, we wanted to make sure that rural and farming communities weren't outweighed or outvoted by urban communities. So there's some merit to it. However, what's going on now is, the one thing is the gerrymandering. I can see it in the really blue states or the really red states. Where I worry about it is in the purple states like Virginia, where it's, you know, right now it's 6-5 in favor of
Democrats. We would call them the swing states.
And it's a 50-50 state, and it would be 10-1 if they go through with this. So that's where, you know, it's hard to make the argument in California where it's a really blue state, or Illinois. However, the other big thing is voter ID. Now, voter ID, that's part of this Voting Rights Act, or SAVE Act. You know, I would think most European countries, if not all, require voter ID. We require it to buy beer, to, you know, get on an airplane, get on even getting into the building, right? So, and it polls at 80. It polls at 90 with Republicans. It polls it in the high 50s or 60 with Democrats. And yet the Democrats in the House and Senate don't want to vote for it. So they want to make sure that they can win elections. It's competition. That's okay. You know, we all want to win. But we would like to do it fairly. We'd like to make sure that anybody who votes has to prove that it's that they are, in fact, the person that's registered, and also prove that they're a citizen. I think that's a pretty valid, and most Americans, it's another 80-20 rule, I mean, 80-20 issue that we talk about quite a bit. Why do the Democrats want to die on the hill of an issue that polls at 80?
All right. Lastly, you obviously are the head of Republicans overseas,
yes,
in the UK.
I have a slight bias.
You do, and you're entitled to it, and I'm not critical of that at all.
All good.
But in terms of being a Republican, in your view, is it going to be a wipeout for Republicans in the midterms?
I don't think so. And I'm not being, you know, hyper-partisan here. I would
bet. Is this hope over expectation?
If I had to bet, I would bet the Republicans lose, because the party in power always loses. And however, a couple of real voting expert nerds have said, look, some of the metrics are looking pretty good. Like, which party do you favor? That's dead even right now. And that's unusual. Usually, Democrats lead that metric by 3 or 4 points, even in elections that we do well in. And then it's the economy, right? So if we have real wage growth, if people start feeling, if we get gas down to $3, as I mentioned earlier, and then we have more real wage growth. We've had
and
it already.
And those who suggest that the pressure on oil prices and fuel prices is going the other way.
Oh, I mean, natural gas prices in the U.S. are down, which is wild, because that trades on a regional basis. So
and
up
President Trump's popularity being at an all-time low, is that an issue for the party?
He's rarely run as a popular president, right? He probably peaked at 51, 52. He's still higher right now than Obama was in his second term, and definitely higher than where Biden was in his only term. So, you know, that doesn't help. That we need some, you know, some tailwinds here. And I think that if $3 gas and we get $2,000 of what we lost in the Biden years, we've got 1,000 back, we get 2,000 more.
Is that messaging landing? I'm not convinced that it is.
No, not at all,
because
it's not being messaged.
All right. Well, look, thank you very much for joining us. We really do appreciate it. That is Greg Swenson there, Chair of Republicans Overseas UK.
Thanks, Kira. Thanks for having me.
The Hard Shoulder with Kira Kelly and Shane Coleman.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays at 4 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.